And now, welcome to Who's Talking on WCHL with D.G. Martin. Interesting guests, enlightening conversation. And now, here's your host, D.G. Martin.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is, I'm not going to tell you. Let me ask you a question first. Have we finally found the lost colony that's been missing for many more years than 400 years? No, says my guest, Brent Ling. We haven't found it. Brent is an adjunct professor at the business school, a professor of heritage economics, and he's also a member of the board of the First Colony Foundation. So we haven't found the lost colony, but by focusing on a patch on an old map by John White in the British Museum, Lane has put the lost colony back on the map as far as news is concerned. So, Brent Lane, were you quoted right when you say we haven't really found the lost colony?
I was quoted exactly right. Although usually the headline says lost colony found ? And that is an appropriate question. What we have now, DG, is something that generations of searchers for the colony did not have. What we have is a clue to the possible location of the colonists, and more importantly, it's a clue that was probably left for us by Sir Walter himself.
One of the quotes, I think, from the report of the First Colony Foundation or from the British Museum itself, it summarizes what's happened. After decades of unsuccessful searching, archaeologists may have their best evidence ever of the possible fate of Sir Walter Raleigh's lost colony. It comes in the form of a clue from Sir Walter himself, secreted within the 425-year-old Virginia Pars map drawn by his expedition to site the first English colony in the New World. Now, is that accurate, or is that just trying to...
No, that's very accurate. I appreciate the way that's phrased so cautiously, yet so optimistically, because I think that's the right attitude to have at this point.
Well, just for anybody who missed the front page of the papers a few days ago, really, there was a big flurry, front page news about finding a patch on a map. I mean, what in the world? And all in the patches just got a little symbol of a fort on it that was covered up. Put this in the context of what was the lost colony and why does this map make any difference?
Well, DJ, you're recognizing something that I think is important to recognize, is the excitement and the interest that this discovery has generated. First, the background on the colony. Sir Walter Raleigh, recognizing that Spain had a big head start in terms of populating, colonizing the New World, approached Queen Elizabeth and said it was a matter of national urgency that England establish a presence in the New World. And Raleigh was an entrepreneur. Raleigh was an ambitious gentleman and a bit of a salesman and flamboyant, and he proposed to establish a colony in the New World in the late 16th century. And he got the Queen to give him the exclusive opportunity to do so. He launched two colonies to the New World. The first came over in 1585 and stayed for a year. And they did a wonderfully thorough job of exploring this New World, mapping it, meeting its people, identifying its resources, natural resources, mineral resources, and produced an absolutely superb map of coastal North Carolina. A map that so carefully shows the shoreline, that so carefully identifies the Indian villages they visited. It's a masterpiece of scientific achievement that, unfortunately, I think has been really unappreciated.
So we've gotten focused on the next colony, on Virginia Dare and the Lost Colony, rather than on this successful, I don't want to call it a scientific expedition, but it was an exploratory colony to find out what was there before the next group came.
I don't think it's wrong to call it a scientific expedition at all. That's exactly what it was. Raleigh had gathered together his dream team of scientists and map makers and navigators, and he organized his effort very carefully, the way we planned perhaps the Apollo missions to the moon. Very similar to that. Organized them in Durham House in London, and was very meticulous in the planning for this, and they did an outstanding job producing this map. And the emphasis on the accuracy of the map is particularly important. When I was examining the map, trying to determine where the Indian villages were that they visited, because my foundation, the First Colony Foundation, is interested in not only the story of the English side of the contact, but also the American Indian side, what struck me was that a map this accurate, this careful, you had to pay attention to every detail on it because every detail was meaningful. And in that context, when I looked at the map, I noticed that there were two patches present on this map, patches that had been apparent to anyone looking at the map for the last 400 years.
Like it's a map patch. I mean, we have a hard time kind of, I mean, we don't patch maps in this time. We just buy a new one or make a new one, I guess, because we got all the equipment. But some of us growing up had patches on our clothes. Something is there, you want to cover it up, or you wear it out and you cover it up. And maps were the same way. If you wanted to correct it, you didn't have a Xerox machine, a color Xerox machine, to color it and then make a new thing. You had to carve out a little piece of paper, or you had to put a piece of paper on top of it and redraw it. And this is what you noticed.
Well, I noticed that, and I believe that's the assumption most historians had looking at the map, that they were simply repairs or corrections. I challenge that assumption. Raleigh was presenting this map to the Queen of England. Raleigh was presenting this map to his London investors.
Well, now, wait a minute. This map is in the British Museum. How are you in any position to do any kind of challenging?
Well, thankfully, I had some good colleagues at the British Museum themselves. So this is a map that's been photographed and published a number of times.
So did you notice the patches from the photographs? Or did you?
Yes, I did. I noticed the patches from the photographs, and I simply concluded that a map of this importance being presented to the Queen, one would not simply slap a patch on there to correct something. Perhaps there was another explanation that had not been explored. And when I asked the British Museum to take the map and give it a little exploration, in particular, to see if there might be something underneath the patches, that's when we discovered
that. Wait a minute. Some guy, some non-scientist like you, you know, a country boy from North Carolina, asking the British Museum, hey, this is a map that's been in your possession for many, many years, and it's been hanging around Great Britain for 425 years, and, you know, every kind of test has been run on it that we can think of to run. You come up and ask us to run some silly test about looking up under the patches. I mean, you have no standing to ask for this, do you? I mean, you're not a scholar or a scientist.
Now, DG, I am a North Carolina boy and a UNC graduate. I have learned something about Southern persuasion.
Mm.
They were not immune to a little North Carolina charm.
Two very nice women working in the back map room who very seldom get paid attention by anybody, and you schmoozed them. Is that right?
I would like to say I appealed to their intellectual curiosity about these patches themselves. I will say it took a few months to persuade them. DG, you probably could have gotten quicker service.
I wonder. I mean, I'm the worst at it. So tell me, because, I mean, this is something. This is off subject, but it is something that we encounter all the time, is what is the appropriate way to ask people for help who really don't believe you have the status to be asking
Tell you my secret weapon. The curator of that particular map at the British Museum, her name is Kim Sloan. She recognized that I was from the University of North Carolina, a school her daughter had attended for a year.
Okay. So the Carolina connection.
I believe, got their attention. And even though they didn't jump on the opportunity to help, eventually they did look. And from that moment forward, they have been extraordinarily helpful to us.
What you asked them to do, this is like fiddling with an art object, because this map, I wish we could show it to people, and maybe we'll have a link on our website, so you can get to see a picture of that map. But it's a beautiful map. I mean, it's a piece of art. It's done by John White, the guy who came with the expedition, did all of these famous illustrations of the way Native American life was when the first English contact came on our coast. So it's a beautiful art object. And when you ask the custodian of art objects to start lifting patches or, you know, doing something underneath it, it's not something that you can just pick up a Band-Aid and put it back on again. So how did you get them to look under the patch?
Well, fortunately, the map itself had been part of an exhibit of John White's watercolors that had traveled to North Carolina just a few years ago. So I think there was a comfort level with a North Carolina question. So a number of things converged perhaps to give me some advantage. And the reality was the first examination they did was as simple as it could be. The later examinations were very technical. But the first examination was they took the map, which was now unmounted, previously had been mounted on a hard surface for the last 150 years. Very simple explanation why they couldn't see through it then. They placed it on a light
table.
Why was it off
the hard cover? It's for some other reason, I guess.
It was off of the board because they had prepared it for the exhibit to North Carolina.
And they had not replaced it on a board. They felt it was better from a conservation
They had remounted all of John White's drawings, of which this they was just one, on mountings where you could see the back of the drawing as well as you could the front. And in fact, it was some of the other John White drawings that I had seen the back of that made me curious as to what was on the back of the map.
So I want to ask one other question before we get to what they found. But all right, you're asking all these questions, and your colleagues in the First Colony Foundation with real scholars of who have different fields of expertise, some of which overlap with this custodianship of a map, and they have their own ideas about the lost colony and what happened, and they've theorized. And did you discuss with them your thoughts about this before you asked the British Museum, or did you just go out kind of on a errand of your own?
No, you're right to point out that the team I was working with are eminent scholars and archaeologists. I'm humbled in their presence, which is a rather unusual occurrence. But they are absolutely our version of a dream team for studying the contact period of the late 16th century. We got together at my office building at the business school at UNC, and we spent a good afternoon talking about all the things that we knew and all the things we didn't know about the colony, because we've been actively excavating on Roanoke Island in search of the first colony, the Lane colony is referred to, and their location on Roanoke Island.
Now, just for anybody who joined us late, we think of the Lost Colony as being the first colony. Actually, as you pointed out earlier, there was we call it a scientific research party, and this is what you're calling, this is really the first colony, the Lane colony.
The Lane colony, headed by Rafe Lane, or Ralph Lane as he's usually known, was the one that stayed for about a year and did the exploration work and really laid the ground for the permanent settlement colony of men, women, and children.
So you can go on Roanoke Island and you can find these separate sites for the Lane colony and the Lost colony. It looks like it would be kind of all mixed up together.
Well, it is all mixed up together. And in truth, what's left on Roanoke Island is very limited in what's been found there.
All right. Well, now getting back, you've got them in the room and you're saying, hey, I want to see the patch. And are all of them saying, hey, you're right, Brent. Somebody should look at the patch. Are they saying, look, Brent,
you're being very generous in your assumptions, DJ. One of my advantages, and I think something that people who are eminent scholars in their field are sometimes handicapped by, is you don't become eminent in your field without narrowing your focus quite a bit. So they knew a tremendous amount about a little bit. And in combination, they were quite a force. But separately, I don't believe any historians or archaeologists had ever looked at this map from the perspective of someone from the water. The map was drawn by navigators in small boats. I had worked as a geologist in those same waters. So I looked at the map as being drawn under circumstances of rough seas and small boats where the details of the coastline were urgently needed to be known, at the peril of the mariners.
So somebody like me, and maybe even other scholars who are interested solely in history, would look at the map and say, this is just incredibly beautiful, and let's focus on Roanoke Island and where they were. And my gosh, they did a great job of showing the coastline of North Carolina.
I do think you'd appreciate it as a work of art. I appreciate it as a marvelous navigational chart. And from that, my emphasis on the accuracy of the map led me to question all the details that were apparent on there, including those patches that irritated me. So,
visiting with Brent Lane, we're talking about the recently discovered patches on a map in the British Museum, which give us a clue about where the lost colonists might have gone from Roanoke Island. And Brent Lane and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Brent Lane. Brent is an adjunct professor at the Business School at the University of North Carolina, teaching heritage economics, and he's also on the board of the First Colony Foundation. In that capacity, is interested altogether in all aspects of the early colonization efforts by the English on the coast of North Carolina. And we were talking about how you might be in a position to raise a serious question about patches on a map. You're surrounded on the American side by a bunch of scholars who know lots of stuff, and I've asked you several times whether or not they jumped in to agree with you about the patches, and you've deflected you've taken me other places every time. I'm thinking if I were there, here's what I would have said, assuming that I had the scholarly backbone to do it. I would have said, Brent, I would have been diplomatic. I would have said, Brent, that's just a great thought. I mean, but Brent, you know, I mean, they've had 425 years to think about these patches, and surely, if there were anything to it, somebody would have already gotten to it. You know, you're not going to be the first person in 400 years to raise this. Why don't we get back to what we know best, which is what's going on in North Carolina?
Well, D.G.,
did anybody say that?
Not in so many words, but you pointed out one of the great things about being at a university is you find yourself constantly surrounded by people who know more than you do in their area of specialty, which gives me the latitude to ask stupid questions, sometimes about the obvious. And in this case, the obvious question was, why were there patches on the map? And my colleagues were glad to have give me something I could go and pursue.
So they said, let him go off on this own errand. He's not going to find it. They were nice, but they didn't jump on it and say, hey, man, we should have thought of this.
I think they would have been hesitant personally to approach the British Museum with such a simple question as this. I was undaunted by that. That's essentially been my career.
If you joined us late, what Brent Lane did was to ask the British Museum to take a 425-year-old map and to look under two patches, which caught Brent's attention, just to see if there were anything interesting about it. Again, if you joined us late, what Brent suspected and hoped to find was maybe the location of an Indian village that had gotten covered up by the patch. But when they looked, tell us about, you said once they got going with it, they did it very quickly. And what did they find out? Were you there when they looked?
Now, let me describe what happened. I was communicating with the experts at the British Museum by email and reminded them of their offer to examine the map a little more closely at my request. And on a Thursday, I sent an email asking if they'd had a chance to look at it, and they responded they'd get right to it. The next morning was a Friday. It was in February, the 24th of February, and I remember it well because that morning I had just come out of the dentist office and received an email on my phone, and I sat in the parking lot, and the email from the British Museum says, we looked at the patches, and we found something interesting. Here's what we found. And I clicked on the attached file.
So you got your iPhone or something like that?
I got it on my little smartphone.
On your smartphone, and so the image came across.
And I clicked on the image, and it opened up. And I just marveled at it for a moment. because it revealed something that had not been seen in 425 years.
Under this patch that nobody looked under?
Under a very small blank patch on the northern part of the map.
This is not, we're talking about the lost colony, so this is something on Roanoke Island, or where is the patch?
No, it's conspicuously not on Roanoke Island. It's inland about 50 miles from Roanoke Island in an area of North Carolina now called Bertie County, at the headwaters of the Albemarle Sound, where the Roanoke River splits off to the west and the Chowan River up to the northwest. Two rivers that the colonists had explored.
Where Bertie County? What would be the nearest small town to Bertie County?
Every town near it is small. The nearest dot on a map is named Mary Hill. The nearest town
County seat of Bertie.
County seat is Windsor.
It's Windsor.
It's a lovely little town. It's an old town from the 17th. Well, the early 18th century, 1700.
So all the patch that you were interested in is located what is somewhere over the present day Bertie County.
Yes.
And all right, so what did they find there?
What was found under the patch was a fort, a brilliant blue and red fort drawn in the colors that John White used consistently on that map. It's a fort that is nearly identical to a type built in the late 16th century, the very same time of the colony. So we know the fort, the symbol represents a fort.
Actual fort? Or is this, I mean...
Is the great question. Is it a fort they planned? Was it a fort they built? That's to be determined. But it is a fort that was placed on the map at a very prominent and colorful location.
Well, let me ask the stupid question, since... You're a smart guy now. And you can,
that's my job, DJ.
You don't have leverage to ask the stupid question. But if they were drawing a map, did they not have ways to indicate what was existing and what was planned or what was just put there for decoration? Did John White, the map maker, not have any way to do that?
No, he did not. In fact, on this map, they're so careful in locating the Indian villages that were real villages they had visited. Everything else on the map we know existed. The only indication of where the colonists were was this hidden fort symbol.
Where the colonists were or where the colonists might be
touched on exactly the big question. Was this where they planned to be? Was this where they were? Was this a plan that they changed?
Well, this is what I'm getting real in terms of serious questions. Of course it wasn't where they were. If it was where they were, then when everybody came looking for them, they had the map to show where they were. And no, you know, so I mean it would have, I mean, isn't that right? I mean, what's that this has got to be where they might build. I mean, what we've said is that it is. You've taught me this. I should ask a question, but I'll just answer it. This location is at the confluence of two important North Carolina rivers that if someone were planning on making a larger colony than just on Roanoke Island, this would have given transportation routes over a large part of eastern North Carolina. And this place where the fort symbol was would have been a natural place to have a hub.
It was obviously a superior location to Roanoke Island. And this is a point I think even those of us who know the story of the Lost Colony need to be reminded that the first colony that came over from Sir Walter Raleigh, the Lane Colony, explored for a year, recorded the locations, went back to London, and then began the preparations for the second colony, the permanent settlement of men, women, and children that came over in 1587. Now, while they ultimately became lost, initially they located on Roanoke Island, with no intention of staying there. Their intention was stated that they would go 50 miles into the main.
Where is that intention stated?
Stated by John White himself in his account of the 1587 colony. John White, who was now the governor of the new colony.
Same guy as the guy who made the map.
The same illustrator from
the
previous
colony. Now, the map had already been made, though, by 1587.
The map had already been made by that point.
So John White comes back. He's left the map in England with his buddy, Sir Walter Raleigh, presumably. He didn't take them out.
We could assume that a version was left there, but we could also assume a version came with white.
Oh, okay. So,
but those are all,
or at least his notes and work papers might have come with him.
So you could imagine after the first colony returned, there was quite a bit of planning that went on.
Let me ask you this, Brent: when the second colony came, this is what we call the lost colony. It was the scientific work done, and this was the second stage, or was there a continuous surveying and work and testing and exploration that was to be done by the second colony?
The second colony had a very explicit mission, and explicit in the sense that the Parliament of England charged them with creating the city of Raleigh, of course, named for Sir Walter Raleigh himself.
There's a parliamentary act or something.
There's
like
an incorporation of the city of Raleigh in 1587, and the settlement that was sent over, the colonists were charged with establishing the city of Raleigh in the New World.
Wow. This is a good time to take a break. I mean, we got to take a break because I've gone way over time. I'm visiting with Brent Lane, and if you've been with us, you can see I'm pretty excited about the discoveries that he made. He and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Brent Lane. We're talking about the lost colony. We're talking about this incredibly interesting discovery in which Brent has had such a large part, basically taking a map that was drawn right about the time of the lost colony. He saw a patch on it. We've looked into the patch, or the people at the British Museum have looked into the patch. And what they found was a patch right above where Bertie County is, 50 or so miles inland from the lost colony. And under that patch, there is a symbol for a fortress. And so, Brent, you're just sort of telling us what this might mean, what it probably doesn't mean. Your guess is as to what it really does show.
A lot of my career has been spent working with entrepreneurs and investors. So I look from Sir Walter Raleigh's perspective as an entrepreneur appealing to investors. He had a map that he used not only to plan the permanent colony and to plan his city of Raleigh, but he also used it to show his investors his progress. To me, this fort symbol most likely was Raleigh's planned capital city, the city of Raleigh.
And this was the plan on which you've now told me that the English Parliament came along and gave authority to this to say, okay, you have official government permission, in fact, direction to establish this city. And we assume that Raleigh had shown them the map and that this is the contemplated location of the big city that the colonists would, or the big relative to what is at Roanoke Island. But with hundreds of people there, the first new English city in the New World.
And indeed, the intention was to eventually have hundreds of people locate there. The colonists who came over, 117 men, women, and children, were really just the first population to locate there. Now, we do not know that they intended to or did locate where this symbol is based, but the symbol's appearance fits so much of the rest of the evidence that it makes it a compelling reason to explore in that area. Now, what we haven't mentioned is, after drawing this new city of Raleigh, it was then concealed by the patch.
Now, you speculate, or there has been speculation that's developed about why in the world, after this fortress, the planned city of Raleigh, perhaps, or just decoration that John White might have put on there, but assuming that it was the planned site, why would you, if you're out there trying to sell it to your investors, sell it to the Queen, sell it to the Parliament, and having some success for that, why all of a sudden would you cover it up?
Raleigh had a dilemma. While he needed to be able to tell his investors and his queen about his successes and about his plans, he also had to conceal this from the Spanish, who were actively seeking to find and destroy this new colony from the English.
Well, he's not in Spain, he's in England.
No, but Spain had plenty of spies in the queen's court.
In Is fact, that right? Did they really?
Absolutely. In fact, much of what we know about the Raleigh colony actually comes from the Spanish archive, where those spies' reports are
now,
housed.
Now, these two countries are at each other's throats. Their war develops just within a year or two after this. And I think there are some either authorized or some semi-authorized privateers already fighting each other.
Oh, absolutely. Those of us who are old enough to remember, this was at the height of the Cold War between England and Spain. And all the espionage that we saw in our own Cold War experience was taking place between the English and the Spanish.
So there were English people in the court who were on the payroll of the Spanish government and pretending to be loyal subjects, but sending intelligence reports, or were there official Spanish ambassadors who got a chance?
We could assume all of the above, DG. It was an area of tremendous intrigue and mystery, which is why the British Museum, when they looked at the patch, one, that first there was a fort, two, it was covered up. A closer examination of the patch itself revealed that a version of that same fort had been secretly redrawn on top of the patch and redrawn in what they could only conclude was a form of invisible ink.
Well, one of the things that pops up into my mind, this is an argument about, that's an ongoing argument about, are we going to put this on here or not? And Raleigh was known to be mercurial and make decisions and then change his mind, that he said, okay, put it on. Well, no, maybe somebody else would want the fort someplace else. Let's cover it up and leave it to be decided. Maybe we want an investor who wants it someplace else. And so we'll just, and then they change their mind again. Rather than worrying about just the Spanish, it might have been from an entrepreneurial standpoint. I've seen land developers work on their maps for proposed subdivisions before, and they'll put the clubhouse one place when they're talking to one group and then have it in a different area when they're talking to somebody else.
That is certainly a very reasonable alternative explanation. It was a planned development that at the height of a real estate bubble perhaps fell through. That is a very that's a nice, simple explanation and a reasonable one, but the invisible fort drawn on top of the patch causes us to ask, is indeed something more to it?
Well, we can make different and reasonable explanations about why there might have been a patch to cover the fort. I'm having trouble developing in my own mind a reasonable explanation why you would put on top of the patch in invisible ink something that nobody could see. That's just a tough one for me. Is that giving you any trouble at all, or have you got a good explanation for that?
Well, the use of invisible ink was actually one of the conventions of the time, and there certainly are ways to draw something in invisible ink and then be able to reveal it to a select audience. The interesting thing about the invisible ink is it reminds me so much of my childhood memories of science class and invisible inks, because what was in use at the time of Queen Elizabeth and Sir Walter Raleigh was the use of milk or lemon juice or, in some cases, urine, which we didn't do in grade school, not deliberately. So the same sort of invisible inks that we grew up hearing about were exactly what they were using at the time.
And can we tell on this patch where there's an invisible recreation of what's under the patch? Can we tell what the invisible ink was, or we just see it's...
Well, ironically, once you know that there's a patch, that the patch covers a fort, that invisible image has been visible for the last 100 or so years simply by aging. If you look at the map today and look on top of the patch, knowing that there's a fort underneath it, you will see the fort drawn on top of it. So the invisible ink is no longer invisible.
Sort of like the Shroud of Turin.
It is very similar to that, DG. The British Museum examined what made the image on top, and they eliminated every form of pigment that was used in the period and concluded only that he used some form of fluid that was invisible until heat treated.
Is it possible that everything's possible, but is it possible and semi-likely that the invisible ink put on there or some kind of representation on top of on the patch which covered up the fort symbol, that could have been done many years later when somebody just said, look, this was here, let's put it back.
That was my initial reaction, DG. But the fort drawn on top of the patch, the invisible fort, is similar to, but not exactly like. It's an evolution of the underlying fort. So had you or I simply noticed the underlying fort, we might have traced it. And what you would have had on top would have been a fairly exact replica of it. But it is an evolution of what's underneath, which suggests that someone involved in placing the first fort symbol redrew a more elaborate version invisibly on top of the map.
We're visiting with Brent Lane. We're talking about the Lost Colony, and in particular, a map that was drawn by John White, the great artist and governor of the second colony, that shows underneath a patch that Brent Lane noticed and made them look for a fort that probably represented the planned city of Raleigh that would have been the center of that colony. Brent Lane, and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Brent Lane. We're talking about an exciting, front page news on our local newspapers, very prominently displayed in the New York Times, what Brent really did. He made us look under a patch in a 425-year-old map and found probably what was meant to be the central city of the projected Sir Walter Raleigh-led colony. All right, so where are we, Brent? I could talk about this all day long, but we're about out of time. What can we look for to happen as a result of this discovery?
Well, you've pointed out how interesting this story is to you and I, but what's remarkable is it's been interesting around the world. We've been hearing from people from 92-year-old to fourth grade classes.
Yeah, Google a Lost Colony map and WIMO. Yeah, you're going to get a lot of stuff.
And what is important is indeed people are asking, what do you do next? Well, what has to be done next is to do the hard work of finding history. And in many cases, it's the archaeological work. We need to be on the ground, and we, meaning archaeologists and perhaps the First Colony Foundation, examining both what has been found in that area by local collectors and archaeologists themselves before, and perhaps also doing some actual excavations eventually when we've narrowed the area down to a couple specific locations. And then there's another challenge.
That's something over a few months or 10 years, or is it a lifetime?
You should think of it as a 10-year, it's a decade opportunity and challenge, because this area has been occupied by Native Americans for thousands of years, and really by early English settlers and colonialists and Americans for the last 350 years.
So we're going to find lots of things.
We're
it's a question
find.
Of how would you know whether or not it something that the if the theory that the lost colonists may have made their way somewhere near this site, they wouldn't have been able to bring a lot of stuff with them. I mean, it wasn't like they're packing, they're packing truckloads of stuff. They're carrying just a few things with them.
Well, so you're right to point out the challenge is to identify what perhaps 100 people, men, women, and children, left behind as litter after they had moved from Roanoke Island. Fortunately, the team we have at First Colony has a lot of expertise at sites like Jamestown and Roanoke Island. That specific few decades of contact where you have Native American presence followed by English presence, and it's that intersection between the two that we're looking for. There are some distinctive artifacts from that period that we'll be looking for.
What kinds of artifacts would it all be pottery or eating implements or what knives? What kinds of things?
There will be pottery. There will be some metal objects. There will be some particularly important things to find, items that were used in scientific investigations that still would have been part of the colony's baggage, crucibles that were used to heat and test metals. Those are the things that would be very helpful in pinpointing that we had found colonists from 1587.
Well, now you got a job. You got jobs are you going to quit them and go spend full time on this thing that has gotten you? I mean, you know, after a lifetime of working, both teaching and working, and now you never made the front page of the News Observer before, or the or been a world figure before. That's kind of tempting just to stop and enjoy that for a while.
No, not that tempting, DG. Actually, this is part of my job. I work at the UNC Kenyon Flagler Business School, and we work with communities in their economic development. My argument is that heritage is one of the ways we develop our communities. It's one of the ways we enhance our schools. We need to engage students from our local schools in the Bertie County area as part of this process. This can be a wonderful addition to the heritage of not just Bertie and East North Carolina, but North Carolina itself. That will have benefits in education, it will have benefits in the economy, it will attract visitors and tourists. So I see this as a wonderful asset for this part of North Carolina that is rich in heritage and challenged in many other areas. This is one of the undeveloped great assets of northeastern North Carolina, and I hope that as we look for the site of the colonists of the last decade, we'll have broad participation by citizens in the region and visitors from elsewhere who will be part of this exploration.
Well, Brent Lane, congratulations on a real solid and interesting achievement, and thanks for sharing it with us today. Our guest has been Brent Lane. Thanks to him. Thanks to you for listening. It's been Who's Talking with D.G. Martin, and I'll be back here before you know it.